All rise. The Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla presiding.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today on the bench are my colleagues, Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 89296 in the matter of Teamer versus Summers. At council table, I believe we have Timothy Wiseman, counsel for appellant Ariel Teamer. And at respondents table, we have attorney Brett Whipple, counsel for respondent Quentin Summers. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Wiseman, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Very good. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Your Honors, there are two primary issues here today. The first is that Ariel contends the trial was unfair to her for a couple of reasons, but principally the way the district court handled the request for admissions. And second, the question of whether the district court gave proper consideration to the child's health issues when issuing its decision. Regarding the first matter, Your Honors, Ariel submitted requests for admissions to Defendant Quentin. Defendant Quentin never submitted answers as far as the record shows. They were not submitted timely or at all. Under NRCP 36, as a matter of law, they were therefore deemed admitted. A notice to that effect was filed before the trial began. Now, the district court may, of course, set aside admissions deemed admitted for a couple of reasons, including upon motion, or under its discretion in Woods. However, Woods applies primarily, if not exclusively, when admissions were responded to late, rather than the situation as here, where no responses were provided whatsoever.
Mr. Wiseman, was there a concern of service of the admissions in this issue and whether or not they were actually properly and timely served?
Your Honor, there was some concern about that. However, the record shows that service was completed both upon Quentin and upon his counsel at the time. In fact, in the later filed motion to set aside the admissions, there was a statement that Quentin's attorney at least had received them. Now, there is some genuine doubt as to whether Quentin had seen the admissions, was aware of their content, or excuse me, I should say, whether he had seen the request for admissions and whether he was aware of their specific content. However, there does not seem to be any doubt that at a minimum, his attorney was aware, that he was aware they had been served, even if he did not know their content, and the record suggests that service was complete upon him specifically in addition to his attorney.
Wasn't the attorney in the process of withdrawing, or was there some issue regarding the continuity of legal representation?
Oh, very much so. His attorney was, in fact, in the process of withdrawing, and that may very well have been what resulted in the admissions not being responded to. However, that does not change the circumstances. In fact, I would contend that under NRCP 36, that's not even a primary factor. Now, once it comes into the court's discretion, of course, the court may consider whatever factors it finds appropriate, but under NRCP 36, the factors the court should consider, at least as principal matters, are whether setting aside the admissions would serve the presentation of the matter on the merits, and whether it would create prejudice for the requesting party.
Well, Mr. Wiseman, wouldn't you agree that permitting withdrawal of the admissions in this case did in fact promote the presentation of the merits?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. In this case, every single one of the requests for admissions were things that Ariel believed to be true, that Ariel contends would have been proven by the evidence had the matter been fully discussed at trial. However, in this case, there were two things that prevented those things being brought forth fully at trial. The first, and the two factors work together. The first is Ariel's counsel believed that he could rely on the request for admissions being admitted. Raising the issue, especially without a jury, could only really weaken his case. And second, and this works alongside the first, there were time limits. There were quite strict time limits, which, to be clear, is a perfectly proper exercise by the district court. But it does mean that the counsel is not going to spend his very limited and precious time addressing factors he believes are already set in stone.
So you wrote in your brief that none of the requested admissions constituted a trap, but didn't several of the admissions request that Quentin admit to criminal acts and acts of domestic violence?
Yes, in fact.
And he, in fact, denied those things when questioned on cross-examination.
Yes, and perhaps I should be slightly more clear. The request for admissions addressed things that would have likely affected the district court's determination. And that is, in fact, significant because it is our contention this is not harmless error, that these things likely would have mattered. However, there was no request that he admit something that would have by itself destroyed his entire case.
You don't think, in light of the statutory presumption that a parent who's committed domestic violence can't have joint or sole physical custody, that wouldn't have been effectively a case concluding type sanction had he been forced to admit that?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that it would not. Now, those are significant presumptions. These are significant matters. However, the district court would have still retained a certain amount of discretion. Those are presumptions, not absolute determinations. There was nothing asking for him to admit that she should receive primary physical custody. And perhaps more significantly in this case, even if it was proper for the district court to set aside the request for admissions, and I would very respectfully contend that it was not, but even if it was, the real problem, the biggest problem at least here, was the timing.
Okay, well, didn't the court give Ariel notice on the very first day of the evidentiary hearing that at that point it couldn't deem her requests or the request conclusively admitted, correct? And didn't Ariel question Quentin extensively about the request for admission on that first day and even on the second day?
Your Honor, the court did make a statement along those lines suggesting that it was not inclined to find them deemed admitted. However, there is a significant difference between that and a statement that it was not going to, that there was a finding they were set aside. Moreover, even if it was still done on that first day, that meant it came after discovery. It meant it came after all trial preparation had come. In fact, it meant it was coming essentially at the start of trial. Even if that had been a definitive statement, an absolute ruling that the request for admissions were not going to be deemed admitted, I would still suggest that creates so much prejudice for Ariel that it needed to be addressed. And yes, Ariel's counsel did address some of the matters that are also addressed in the request for admission. There are reasons that that is necessary, both to elaborate upon them beyond a bland admission and to lay the groundwork for further items. However, Ariel's counsel did not go over all of them. I would also respectfully submit that the simple fact that Quentin's counsel subsequently filed a motion to set them aside indicates that even Quentin's counsel did not believe that as of the start of trial, as of the first day, they had been deemed to be set aside. That even Quentin's counsel was acknowledging there was at least a possibility the court was going to treat them as admitted. And this is further shown on the record at the start of the discussion of the second day of trial, which came significantly later, where both counsel and the judge discussed the matter, and effectively the final word on it was Ariel's counsel saying it is our position they are deemed admitted. Neither the opposing counsel nor the judge responded to that by saying, no, they aren't.
Okay, Okay, what do we do with the fact that on the second day of the evidentiary hearing, Ariel admitted that she relocated with AS to Arizona and that she lied to the court when she testified at the February 2023 hearing that she hadn't? And effectively, there's clear and convincing evidence in the record that she abducted the child. And then the court found that that wasn't rebutted. What do we do with that?
Your Honor, that is an appropriate factor for the district court to consider, and it is a factor that I must confess does weigh strongly against Ariel. But just as allegations of domestic violence by Quentin, assuming they were set in stone, do not end the case, neither does that. These are factors that the district court can take into consideration at its discretion, and they are heavy factors. But nonetheless, they remain factors that the court can consider and that can be outweighed by other factors, especially when both sides have challenging facts on their side.
So, Mr. Weissman, wouldn't, in that situation, she now has the presumption against her because of the abduction. Mm-hmm. Isn't her only hope at this point to try to get a presumption against Quentin through the domestic violence situation? She said she was attacked hundreds or thousands of times. Couldn't she have given some examples of, to attempt to convince the court that the presumption should apply there, and perhaps then competing presumptions would be in place, then she would have an argument for custody. But with the abduction presumption against her, she's dead in the water.
My understanding of the law, Your Honor, is that it is not quite so strong as she would be dead in the water at that point. Now, with that said, she is, of course, at that point facing a very heavy burden, and perhaps strategically, her best option is to establish a competing presumption. But whether or not that competing presumption should be applied is then an evidentiary matter.
Mr. Weissman, right. Let me ask this.
I just follow up on that.
Absolutely.
So she had the admissions, that's what she's relying upon. But if she said she was attacked hundreds of times, couldn't she provide some evidence? Would she just rely on the admissions when they were unclear if the court was going to accept them? Just present some evidence to try to get the domestic violence presumption?
Perhaps it would have been better if she had, and I will likely acknowledge that it would have been better if she had, but that is an evidentiary matter and a trial strategy matter, and is a trial strategy and evidentiary matter in a situation where she and her counsel believe that that was deemed admitted. Under those circumstances, and with limited time available in trial, she was largely relying on those admissions, and there's authority stating she had a right to do precisely that. If there were
any authority in the family law context that she had the right to do that?
No. Let me rephrase. I am not aware of any authority specifically in a family law context.
Let me ask this question. Mr. Weissman, do we need to be concerned about the Blanco case?
Absolutely. The
Blanco. So how do you distinguish that from the facts of your case, and why shouldn't we treat the failure to answer the admissions perhaps as a sanction? And when Blanco says we really shouldn't be considering sanctions for discovery conduct in the context of determining child custody.
Absolutely. The Blanco case effectively states that case terminating sanctions in a child custody case are absolutely improper. And that makes complete sense because the primary concern is the best interest of the child. In fact, the only concern is the best interest of the child. However, in the Blanco case, the district court struck a pleading. It effectively was truly case-ending sanctions. The appellant in that case, was then not permitted to produce virtually any evidence. The appellant was not permitted to bring significant arguments in front of the district court whatsoever. In this case, the party, Quentin, still could have brought legal argument, still could have raised other matters, did raise other matters very persuasively, and this was not a case terminating sanction. Also, while I do contend that the request for admission should not have been set aside, if that was the determination, if they were going to be set aside, the problem was the timing and the lack of ability to properly address it. At best, Ariel and her counsel received notice that they might conceivably be set aside at the start of the first day of trial, when there was no discovery and effectively no time to prepare. And then in between the first and the second day of the trial, the motion to have them set aside was denied. Ariel's counsel therefore had every reason prior to the beginning of the second day of trial to believe that those were set in stone, that there was not any longer even a metaphysical doubt. There was some discussion of that matter at the beginning of the trial, but that was after the preparation for the second day. And that discussion ended with Ariel's counsel saying, it is our position that the admissions are admitted, with neither the opposing counsel nor the judge correcting that. In other words, he proceeded with the final day with very limited time, having every reason to believe they were admitted. If they were going to be set aside, and there is reason to do so, but if they were going to be set aside, that needs to be clearly communicated, preferably while discovery was open, and certainly while there was still time to prepare for the trial.
Nothing prevented Ariel from discussing the episodes of domestic violence during the proceedings, during trial, did it?
Well, she was not forbidden from doing so. However, there was limited time and a belief that those requests for admissions were admitted. Under that circumstance, it would have been a bad use of her time for her to do so. And that's why it was effectively glossed over and other things were focused on, other things that she and her counsel believed were genuinely in dispute.
Mr. Weissman, I'm sorry you are just about out of time, but we will we'll give you an opportunity for a couple of minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the court. First of all, it's a pleasure being here. It's the first time I've ever appeared before this Court of Appeals. I've been in front of the Supreme Court a couple times, and I appreciate the opportunity to address these issues in front of the court.
Have you been in this courtroom before?
No.
How do you like it?
It's beautiful. Okay. It's very beautiful.
So, I see your picture up there, too.
I'm not even going to look. I know better than that. So, I was a firsthand attorney on this. I was a trial attorney, and so I have a little bit clearer perspective and memory, I think, than Mr. Weissman may have, only because I was, you know, in the heat of the battle. I think what's significant is to identify the two separate dates of the evidentiary hearing. This was an evidentiary hearing that was on February 20th, and on that date, my client showed up pro per. Mr. Summers was alone, and then after that date ended, he then came to my office and retained my services. We continued the second evidentiary hearing to May 15th, and that was concluded on May 15th. But the significance of this issue before the court with regard to the request for admissions came up at the beginning of the first hearing date on February 20th, when I was not even present, and Mr. Summers was in a pro per position. And ironically, that was the same exact date that the attorney across the aisle, Ms. Barnes, had requested the admissions conclusively being admitted. It was on February 20th, 2024.
Was that even necessary to request that? Aren't they automatically admitted?
So that is a great question, and that's probably the heart of the issue before us here today, because my position is to argue that no, until you actually receive them, they're not. How could Rule 36 apply until you actually receive the document? And as identified by the court, and by the trial court, which I'll cite here in a minute, there was confusion because his attorney, that before I got on, Mr. Freeman, had filed a motion to withdraw, and had actually believed he had withdrawn, even though there wasn't an order in place. And so the trial judge recognized that specific issue, and before they even started the trial on the 20th, this is before I'm even involved, this is a trial court that says, when I have a pro per that it has to have where your client can be served, the address and email, it didn't have that, referring to the request for admissions. So I had my clerk send it back to say, please include the client's last known address and email, and it never was resubmitted by the previous attorney. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a trial court, so as far as I'm concerned, I have not signed any orders allowing Mr. Warren Freeman to withdraw as counsel of record. And then she drops down. If I'm not able to find that Mr. Summers was served with it, I'm unable to move forward. Now, I'm cutting and pasting here. I'm unable to move forward on the findings that conclusively admitted if, in fact, Mr. Summers does not have proof that he opened it. In other words, so the heart of the issue, I think, before you is, what is the significance of requests for admissions? Well, Rule 36 speaks to that. But there's a caveat, right? There's a reason we have judges is because we don't live in a perfect world. What happens if the respondent never received it?
Shouldn't the judge have just made a decision that day so it wouldn't be left hanging throughout this trial?
I think she did. I mean, that's what she did. I am unable to move forward on the findings. That is as clear as it, I mean, she didn't say the document that they had presented that very day is denied. You know, she just said, I am unable to move forward on the findings.
So does that mean then the other side was on notice that, hey, these are not admitted and you better present your whole case?
Exactly. Not only that, they filed it on the same date as the hearing itself. So to suggest that they were somehow taken advantage of and didn't have notice or there was no warning, you know,
why was the motion then filed to withdraw the admissions?
Well, that's another great question. And then the 14th is what we're hitting to next. So Mr. Summers came in, retained my services. I saw that this was an issue, so I filed the motion out of abundance of caution. Okay, because you know, there's a gray area, because even though the court says I'm able to move forward on the findings, I needed clarification. Now here's where I'm going to throw myself on the sword. We did an order to show time, we did an OST, shortened time. And the court placed it on the day before the trial. They did it on the 14th instead of the 15th. And so I had put it on the 15th, so I didn't even show up on the 14th. I had filed a motion to set these aside. So on the 14th, because I was thinking it was the 15th, they just denied my motion to set it aside. And so when I showed up on the 15th, I realized, oh my goodness, there was this issue a day before. But then I pointed out to the court, well, the court, we didn't even need to file a motion to set aside because the court had already pointed out that there was no service. All right, that my client didn't have an opportunity to respond. He was a pro per. The court identified that he was in a pro per situation. His client, his attorney was in the process of withdrawing. He never actually saw him. And even the prior attorney only opened the request for interrogatories. Apparently, in the discovery submission, there was the standard request for productions, interrogatories, and request for admissions. Nobody even opened the request for admissions, not even the prior attorney. So that's why this all came into this issue as, okay, was there service? And there's no suggestion that my client was ever served.
Maybe there's a good basis to set it aside like you requested, but it didn't happen until after the trial was over. So shouldn't the court have been pressed before you left that day to, judge, we need your answer because maybe a continuance will be necessary.
So I was fall back on the fact that they did. And I understand the argument as well that left the trial counsel in a situation where they were unsure what to do. But that's not correct because they filed it the very day of the hearing and they had Mr. Quentin Summers for an entire half day unrepresented to ask any question they wanted. And it was after that half day where he was alone, not having anybody represent him, that he came out and found somebody to represent him. So it was the second day, many months later in May, that I actually just called Ms. Teamer. Okay, so the attorney on the other side that was representing Ms. Teamer had an entire half day evidentiary hearing to ask Mr. Summers questions without any attorney representing him, which is exactly what she did. And she had filed this request for admissions on that same day. So to say that she's somehow biased is I think, is not supported by the facts because she filed it the same.
Prejudice? She's claiming she was prejudiced by the lack of ruling, the timing of the whole situation.
I understand that that's the basis for the argument, but I just don't see any factual support for it because this request for, you know, the request admissions conclusively admitted wasn't even filed until the first day of the evidentiary hearing. So they had all that time to prepare for trial, right? And then they had Mr. Summers for an entire half a day alone without any represented attorney standing by him and protecting him. So And it was only after that that Mr. Summers came and retained my office, and we then went back a second day in May and in fact, addressed some of these issues.
Did she present any evidence of domestic violence committed against her by Quentin Summers?
So you're testing my memory a bit now, and the last thing I want to do is be make misrepresentation, but my memory is not. I remember they've had some, there was a boyfriend in the mix. And I know that the boyfriends and my client had challenged each other. I don't think there was any violence, but I do believe there was an interaction that occurred in Reno and went at a pickup. So the domestic violence against her, I don't think was ever substantiated, but I do recall her having a boyfriend, and there was like a challenge to a fight that occurred that never, the fight didn't occur, but this challenge happened when they did a transition in Reno at one point.
So what about the abduction? The court made a finding that that was proven and that it was not rebutted.
Well, those are questions that I asked her. I specifically recall that. That was the strength of our case. Just as Mr. Weissman points out, she admitted that she lied under oath. I mean, how could you not, right? Because she said she was in Reno when she's actually in Arizona.
When was it discovered, or how was it discovered, that she had actually moved to Arizona?
My memory is there was a police report or some type of legal document that identified that she was in Arizona, and then that's when I asked her the questions as to where she was and why she was there. That's my memory, but again.
Not there temporarily, she had actually moved.
Oh no, she moved there for better job opportunities. It was again her boyfriend or fiance, whatever the case may be, that had the opportunities down there. Okay. That's my memory.
All right, so what's the effect then of the presumption against custody from abduction? If domestic violence wasn't proven by her against your client, but your client proved abduction against her, where does that leave us?
Well, I think I'm going to join Mr. Weissman. I think it's a very strong presumption. I don't think it's conclusive, but it's a very strong presumption and something that clearly I wanted to have in order to use in my argument.
So what is the effect of an unrebutted presumption? Does it become conclusive once it's unrebutted, or is it still only a rebuttable presumption? I mean, what does that mean? It's rebuttable, but it's not rebutted.
Well, so, but we didn't know if it was what the court was going to find. I mean, when the findings of fact came out in August, right, the court held that there was no rebuttal. Having said that, there was certainly the opportunity for it to occur, and you know, reasonable minds differ as to what her testimony or my client's testimony would support. So,
well, you heard Mr. Weissman today. He said this was not a harmless error. If assuming there was any error, it's not harmless. They didn't get to present their whole case. So how do you respond to that?
They absolutely got to present their whole case. That's why, because they had a half a day with my client on the stand without any protection from another attorney. And they filed these requests for admissions on that same exact day. So that can't suggest that they weren't prepared. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had a half day at him without any representation. And at the end of the day, I think the court's reference to Blanco is dispositive on this issue as well. I don't see any bias situation that occurred because, again, they had a full half a day with regard to my client.
Okay, so that was the first day. What about the second day when you were there?
So that's when I called their Ms. Teamers. I mean, my client, Mr. Summers, was the first day, is my memory, and then I called Ms. Teamer on the second day. And that's when I got out the issue of the, the abduction and the other evidence with her.
She had counsel, right?
Yes.
All right, so weren't they able to present their case even on the second day that this is what happened to me, he attacked me on this date at this time,
and therefore
there's domestic violence or whatever other fact they wanted, including the health issues?
Absolutely, yes, of course, yes.
Was there something about the timing that would have prevented them from presenting their whole case?
No, I see none. I mean, again, that's, I'm an advocate, but I don't see any unbiased. I don't see
it's
anything.
Not like the court cut her off in the middle of a description of a domestic violence incident.
No.
Or the health issue, whether the asthma was a serious problem and your client neglected to take care of the child.
So, again, because I was present, it gives me an advantage. Obviously, the record speaks for itself, but I remember no limitation or time issues in the second day because we just had one witness. We had her. They had him for a half a day, then I had her for a half a day, and we had as much time as we chose, as my memory, with regard to questions and answers. So I, again, to suggest that their attorney was somehow prejudiced, I do not believe the facts substantiate that for a myriad of reasons, but the primary one, again, is to go back to the court's ruling on that same day on February 20th, right before she started asking questions and told him, as far as I'm concerned, he was not served. So I am unable to move forward on the findings these conclusively admitted. These were conclusive. That's all. I think that speaks for itself.
Did you provide any evidence on the second day? Did you provide any evidence, or was it just cross-examination of Ms. Teamer?
So I definitely had evidence. And again, the evidence, I think, that suggested that she had moved to Arizona, my memory of what was presented. But we had a full half a day, as well, as far as I remember. But it was just two witnesses, him and her. Yeah.
Oh, so I was just going to ask, I mean, looking at what the court actually said on that first day, she goes, so we can address that as we get to trial. But at this point, I'm unable to move forward with finding these conclusively admitted. She seems to indicate we can address it as we get closer to trial. That, I mean, how do you read that as a final determination by the court that he wasn't served?
I am unable to move forward on the findings. He's conclusively admitted if you don't have any proof that he opened it. That's what how I read that. I understand she's saying she
can address, we'll address it later effectively is kind of what she seems like she's saying.
So we can address it, and then again, it's open
as we get to trial, but at this point.
Yes.
Yeah. So would you agree that's somewhat open-ended?
Of course. I mean, it speaks for itself. I'm not going to, but at the same time, it's very clear that these admissions conclusively admitted were not granted.
And in response to that,
specifically to this,
Ms. Barnes did end up questioning your client.
Oh,
significantly.
She had a half a day.
Yeah.
Half a day unrepresented.
Let me just ask somewhat of a follow-up question. Mr. Whipple, do you believe that we should treat the failure to answer admissions differently in the custody setting in light of Blanco?
So, yes, I think Blanco rules.
And why?
Yeah, I mean, Blanco speaks to the issue. And again, Mr. Weissman identified that because the court has already made clear it's the best interest of the child as a standard, not a discovery violation. I mean, the court has already heard that multiple times. It's the best interest of the child. And that's why, at the end of the day, the finding of fact went 68 pages. I mean, it was very thorough, very substantial.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Mr. Weissman, I'm going to go ahead and give you a little bit more time so that you'll have a rebuttal. I'll give you 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and we'll see where we go from there.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. All right. My esteemed friend has raised several excellent points. The final one he raised, and perhaps the most significant one here, is whether this is ending the case because of a discovery violation. I would respectfully submit it's not. It is different from Blanco. In Blanco, the case was effectively ended. A pleading was struck. It was treated as a default. Here, matters were deemed admitted. And that is the way it's supposed to happen under the rules, and that is meant to help expedite trial and to establish facts. The establishing of facts is part of the point of discovery. This effectively denied Ariel some of the benefits of her discovery, and in addition to the fact that it led her and her counsel to approaching trial strategy with the presumption that these facts were set, that these facts did not need to be further established. This combination prejudiced her. Even if it were proper to set them aside, and I respectfully contend it was not, that is something they needed to be notified of ahead of time. And speaking of notice, my esteemed friend pointed out that the notice was filed the same day as the start of trial. That is correct, and perhaps it would have been better if it had been filed earlier. However, the filing of the notice, and it was a notice, not a request, at all was a nicety. What they were asking for was something that had already occurred by operation of law.
Now, of course, there is some ability to have those things set aside under the proper circumstances, such as on a motion or under the court's discretion as discussed in Woods. But Woods is different. In Woods, they were filed late. Here, Ariel was denied the benefit of responses completely. They were never filed, not even after the first day of trial. And while the motion was filed, it was filed after the first day of trial and then denied. My esteemed friend suggests that the court's discussion on the first day of trial should have put Ariel on notice, at least at that point. But as the bench already pointed out, the entire quote is, so we can address that as we get to trial. There is, at best, some indication that the court wanted to consider it further. Not that they had been set aside, not that they would be set aside. I appear to have run out of time. I'm so sorry.
You're welcome to finish your statement.
Okay. And because of that, they had every right to move forward with the presumption that they were set aside. And while my esteemed friend is correct, she was not cut off in the middle of the question or anything like that. The trial strategy was developed around the idea that each side was getting approximately 3 hours. Under tight time constraints, you pick and choose what you're focusing on. Not knowing that they needed to address these other items creates prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments and insights into the issues before us. We value your participation in today's argument and deeply appreciate the attorneys participating in the pro bono program and your willingness to serve Nevadans who need legal representation and who otherwise would not have access to it. This matter will remain under submission and this court will issue a decision in the near future. Thank you both.
All rise. The Court of Appeals stands adjourned until the next scheduled oral argument.